from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. The California Labor Commission has issued a ruling declaring that a San Francisco woman who drove for Uber should be classified as an employee, not an independent contractor. Uber is appealing the ruling because if it were expanded to include other drivers, it would upend or disrupt Uber's economic model. As an increasing number of Silicon Valley companies raise billions in investment while their hourly contractors scrape to get by, we consider whether sharing economy companies are at risk from regulators who don't see them as different from other forms of industry. That's coming up on Forum right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. Barbara Ann Berwick of San Francisco recently sued Uber for back wages after driving for the company for about 2 months last year. It would be just a run-of-the-mill employee complaint, except that Uber doesn't agree its drivers are employees. So when the California Labor Commission this week dismissed Uber's case that it's merely a software platform matching transportation demand with supply, the ruling set off alarm bells for Silicon Valley companies operating in what's called the sharing economy. We're joined now by several guests. Eric Newcomer, reporter for Bloomberg Business, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Vina Dubal, associate professor at UC Hastings College of the Law.
Excited to be here.
And on the phone, Russ Roberts, research fellow for the Hoover Institution.
Good to be with you.
Well, Eric Newcomer, let's start with you. Give us a little background here. This isn't Uber's first trip to the courthouse.
No, absolutely not. Anyone following Uber understands that, you know, their business is built on these independent contractors. So they're facing class action lawsuits. There are a lot of questions brewing over sort of the status of their employees. So they sort of saw this coming. In fact, this very labor commission back in 2012 ruled the opposite way and found that one of Uber's independent contractors was an independent contractor. So this is a battle that Uber is fighting all over the United States and thinking about it in Europe and everywhere else is expanding.
And I guess investors on Wall Street haven't yet been spooked by all of this regulatory attention?
No. I mean, you know, a lot of their investors are Silicon Valley venture capital firms who are in this for the long haul and tend to bet that a company is going to be huge or it's going to be nothing. So they're hoping that this sharing economy model, as Uber would call it, will work and that Uber will be able to rely on independent contractors.
Vina Dubal, I'm wondering if you can explain the logic behind people who want to think of these workers as employees. So many of them are doing it part-time to make a little bit of money on the side. And Uber never pretended it was going to make its drivers rich or pay the rent.
Right. Well, this is the question for today's economy. Who is an employee and who is an independent contractor? In Uber's case, they have built their entire business model off of this idea that this is not work, that this is somehow different than work. And that's true not just for Uber, but for
Airbnb,
people and beyond, you know, the sharing
rabbit
economy,
yeah,
right? For janitors, for consultants, for a lot of lawyers, for people in the software field, restaurants. You know, there are all these people who either think of themselves as independent contractors or their companies think of them as independent contractors. And one of the things that that I found in my research is that this dichotomy between employee and independent contractor is relatively new in the post-World War II era, that when we saw the kind of the regime of employment protections rise during the New Deal, there was no debate over who employment protections were intended to protect. Everyone was kind of a worker. Slowly businesses, particularly in the post-World War II era, said, but wait, what if we make our workers, configured our business models differently and lowered our costs and thereby increased our profit and workers could have more flexible lives and they could be more independent? And what you see in an industry like Uber, where now they're largely unregulated, unlike the taxi industry, is that people can only do this as temporary work. right? They can only do this as something part-time because they're not going to be able to make a living off of it.
And what's wrong with that?
Well, the question is, do we want teachers who have to work all day long to then have to work in the evening and make a little money driving Uber? If we do, then maybe there's nothing wrong with that. But if we want to live in an economy, in a country where you can have a job, you can be an employee, get protections, work 9 to 5 and have that be enough, then maybe we want to think about what these business models are doing to the larger economy. You know, the taxi industry, which Uber has effectively been trying to replace, at some point not too long ago, you know, just even prior to 2008, you had workers who did this professionally, who were able to buy homes, albeit not in San Francisco, but in, you know, far out in the East Bay. And there's something to be said for that. There's something to be said for this work being professional labor, and for people being able to support their families and send their kids to college and buy homes off of it, being middle class labor.
Russ Roberts, I don't want to leave you there hanging on the phone. Do you worry about this new casual economy or that you see sort of springing up thanks to these software platforms? Or is it just old school exploitation of labor?
I don't think those are the only two choices. I think the question we have to look at is who's benefiting from this new world and who's being hurt by it. And I think the people who are benefiting from it are the drivers and the passengers. And the people who are being hurt by it are the vested interests of past monopoly protection, which are the cab drivers in the case of Uber. And the fundamental question of the well-being of those workers is the right question, as Vina asked, and I think that's an empirical question. I think there are workers. I've talked to them. There are Uber drivers who make a decent living working full-time. They have limited skills, unfortunately. They're able to drive a car responsibly. That skill does earn a decent living. You have to work hard at it. You have to work a lot of hours. And some people choose that. Other people are driving their Uber because they want a little extra money. A lot of them I've talked to are entrepreneurs waiting for funding to come through. So they work very hard as Uber drivers while they're waiting for that funding. When they have their startup in process, they don't work as many hours at Uber. And I think those are all good things. Uber has to attract people to their platform to drive for them. They have to offer a compensation package that is as good as that worker or a little bit better than that worker could earn elsewhere. They're evidently able to do it. People like it. In fact, many of them quit their cab driving jobs to drive for Uber. So I don't think this is a crisis. I don't think it indicates anything flawed in our economy at the present time. If we're worried about school teachers, we should pay them more. I don't think regulating Uber is the way to fix the problem with certain occupations not being paid well. So I think this is nothing to worry about. In fact, I think it's an incredibly healthy innovation that's made a lot of people's lives better.
Well, Eric Newcomer, we're hearing a lot of people sort of accepting that this new era brings with it a lot of flexibility. And to some extent that using old economy models to describe what's happening here may be too limiting. Do we see other companies, other sharing economy companies like Airbnb and TaskRabbit and the like also coming up against legal and regulatory scrutiny?
Yeah, there's definitely some of all types. I mean, with Uber, with Airbnb, I mean, they're facing regulatory scrutiny on other things even besides sort of this independent contractor issue because, you know, they're really trying to change how work's done. You know, but on the independent contractor issue specifically, yeah, there are questions, you know, Postmates, Instacart, all these big growing tech startups rely on, you know, workers that they can spin up and sort of say, okay, we don't need you right now. We're not going to hire you and our app's going to summon you and our app is going to say, you don't work for us anymore. You don't have a high enough rating. So it's pretty pervasive. And, you know, there is this question, how different is that from what we've seen before? You know, and I think that is one of the big questions. I mean, you look at FedEx just had this big ruling. They settled for, I think it was $228 million, a huge sum, basically conceding that, you know, their workers had been independent contractors. So there are old school businesses that everyone's familiar with that have been trying to leverage independent contractors to do sort of the brunt of their work for a long time. So you have to ask, like, how different is Uber? Is Uber like FedEx, or is the fact that they have a mobile app, they have a rating system, you know, is that truly different and therefore should there be an exception?
The IRS has specific rules designed to gauge how much, you know, the situation really favors the definition of employee versus
Absolutely.
Independent contractor, right? Like, so you might have flexibility of hours on paper, but not really in practice. Vina Dubal, I mean, like, it seems to me that maybe we just have to gauge each company this year and then check again next year and
Right.
check again next year as policies evolve?
This is a huge problem, in part because the distinction between employee and independent contractor varies from state to state, from law to law, from circuit to circuit. Everything kind of stems from what we know as the common law test of control. How much control does the employer exert over his, you know, putative employee? But it's so capacious, right? You have the IRS 20 factor test, but which factor matters the most? How do you weigh the different factors? And the fact that that there is no sort of bright line legal rule means that every commissioner or trial or jury or judge comes down kind of differently. And so it ends up being a policy question, even when it's a legal question, right? So. So the Hoover Institution's gentleman's name is Russ, right?
Russ
and I can have, you know, perhaps different perspectives on Uber, and we can look at the same law and the same facts and try and be as objective as possible, but come down very differently on whether someone is an employee or someone is an independent contractor. So you're exactly right. It's not that just we have to come back every year and reevaluate the situation, but it's such a subjective decision whether someone is an employee or an independent contractor under the law.
Russ Roberts, this seems to argue for some kind of federal rule to clarify things.
Well, I think it's inherently ambiguous is the problem, right? It's not a well-defined, it will never be a well-defined definition of what exactly constitutes an employee or an independent contractor. And I understand that it matters a lot for the law and for the actual practice. As an economist, I look at it and think, it's not obvious to me that this is something the government should be trying to figure out. If Uber drivers are defined as employees, that's going to change the regulatory environment that Uber operates under, and that will, my guess, is actually not be good for their drivers. It'll be good for the drivers who keep their job and not so good for the drivers who don't keep their job. That's what I'm generally interested in. Who wins, who loses, and what are the implications of that for people's well-being? So if we could, you know, forget this technical legal question of what is an exact correct definition of an employee, if we say that Uber has to provide more benefits for its drivers, that's going to make Uber more expensive. It's going to mean that Uber drivers are going to be better treated, the ones who keep their jobs. It means that fewer people will use Uber because it's going to be more expensive than it otherwise was. And that means there'll be fewer opportunities to drive for Uber. It will be more like the rest of the world. And I think that's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing that there's flexibility. I think it's a good thing that there's choice. And I don't think the government should really be in the business of deciding what compensation is in any one industry.
But sometimes the cheapest price is actually a transaction that does not include the full cost of the service provided. Like, for instance, I'm thinking of restaurant workers who, you know, yes, you can choose to tip and doesn't that make us feel good, but so many of them are not making a living wage and are responsible for their own health care costs, you know, over the years, the feet, the back goes, you know, but the restaurant owner is not responsible for those. It's a cost somebody has to pay and the worker pays for it.
I guess the question is who should pay for it and who should have the incentive to make it better and what happens if we try to intervene. So if we stick with Uber for a minute, Uber drivers have to pay for their own gasoline. They have to pay for their own car. Is that fair? I don't know. I'm not good at fair most of the time, maybe in my own family. But the real question then is, why does anyone sign up for Uber? Why are cab drivers quitting to drive for Uber? Why are Uber drivers happily working, paying their own gasoline and having to use their own car, pay for their own car insurance? And the answer is to get them to do that, Uber has to give them a commission that makes that worthwhile. If it doesn't, then they'll have a tougher time attracting drivers. And evidently, they're doing a pretty good job at it. People are eagerly driving and seem to be happy doing it. I don't think this is a problem that needs to get fixed. If you wish that people with low skills had more compensation, that's a different question. We could ask, what could we do to improve the skill sets of American workers? That's an important issue, which I think we're doing a terrible job at. Are workers being prepared through their own choices or the choices we offer for the coming world of that's going to be more technologically complex.
Well, I should step in there and say that I have ridden in Ubers and Lyfts that have been driven by college-educated people who could not find jobs in their chosen profession.
Oh, for sure. I think that's true. I've even thought about driving myself. It seems like an interesting life. But that's not really the issue. The issue isn't that there are people who either have made choices that didn't pan out or that we have certain college areas that don't find or they're not easy to find jobs in. The question is, if we intervene in the Uber market, are we going to make people better off or worse off? It seems like we're going to make them better off. Now, if we required Uber to, just to take a simple example, if we required all Uber drivers to be compensated for their gasoline and for their the wear and tear on their car, would that help them? I don't think it would. I think Uber would lower its commission. Well, we could then say, well, then they have to have a minimum commission. Then Uber will have to raise the prices it charges customers, in which case then there'll be fewer Uber drives taken, and then there'll be less opportunity for people who right now, for whatever reason, are having trouble finding a job. If it bothers you that Uber drivers don't make more, and I think most of us who get in the car would, of course, have some interest in the well-being of the people who are serving us, you could tip them. Right now, I think it's conventional not to tip them. But what people who want to regulate these things feel is that not just you should tip them, we should all be forced to tip them. That sets in motion a set of other changes that often doesn't help the people we're trying to help.
Well, I know people now in the studio are keen to jump in there. Vina Dubois.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to two things. One, I think that Russ is right that a key kind of sociological and maybe policy-oriented question here is, why do people do this? And I think the answer from my sort of my own empirical research is that in many ways they are just desperate. So in fact, I've talked to many taxi workers in San Francisco. My research is focused on San Francisco who did go to Uber briefly because they were being pushed out. And all of a sudden, an industry, the taxi industry that was regulated wasn't, their fares were going down. You know, taxi workers now make 60% of what they once made. They went to Uber and they tried it for a while and they said, this is terrible. The wear and tear on my car is not making it not worth the money that I'm making. The amount of gas that I have to pay is making it not worth the money I'm making. The lack of regulations makes it really a kind of a miserable work. And so I don't know that to say that this is necessarily a decision that people are making that's good for them, that this is a good environment for them is the right kind of way to look at this. And the other response I had is that this idea that if we start regulating Uber, then it's going to raise rates, et cetera. Uber has made an explicit decision here, and I think that we need to be clear about that. They've made a decision to have this business model to pay their CEO a certain amount of money and to give a certain amount of money to their commissioner, to commission to their workers. It's not a this has to be this way kind of situation. In fact, in San Francisco, we have Zazie's, which is this amazing, little brunch spot in Coal Valley where the restaurant owner just, has decided to give her workers pension, to give her workers health insurance, to give her workers $15 an hour. Like there are viable, socially responsible business models that exist out there, and Uber's isn't one of them.
No, well, I know.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. And in which case that cafe should, if you're right, that cafe will thrive and we'll all be happier and we'll see if it spreads. And you are free not to take Uber if you feel it's an exploitive technology that is currently oppressing its drivers. That's not the impression I get. It's not the impression. I think if you did a thorough survey of Uber drivers that they're, quote, desperate and miserable, why are they doing it? Do you really believe that that's their only thing they can do that puts any kind of money on the table? You don't think any of them are enjoying it or find the freedom of setting their own hours across weeks exhilarating? They don't like meeting interesting people?
Certainly they do. But that doesn't mean that they have to do it under the conditions that they're doing it under. In fact, taxi workers as employees in the 1970s and 1980s were doing the same thing, enjoying the same kind of work, and were doing it and able to make a living out of it. And I think the idea that this is unskilled labor is actually really problematic. This is professional work. Driving around the city requires a lot more skill and knowledge than I think you're giving credit for.
Presumably, Eric Newcomer, I see you chomping at the bit to get in there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I spend a lot of time talking to Uber drivers and reading the Uber driver forums. I think it's a bit of a mixed bag. I mean, you look at these calculations of people who have done Uber for a while and they'll be like, you know, you can't make money if there's the depreciation. And then certainly there are drivers who clearly think they can make money. And I think one of the things we have to recognize here is this sort of changes on a regular basis. Yes. You know, I mean, Uber is sending drivers down to music festivals saying, okay, there's going to be a huge music festival. Go down there, make a bunch of money. You know, do they make money that weekend? Who knows? You know, Uber is still figuring out. Drivers are still figuring out where they're going to make money, where they aren't. So there's a lot of variability in how much Uber's charging, when surge is going.
Like, and there are competitors like right. Lyft and other companies,
yes.
You know, and you do see this where if a driver feels like he or she is not getting a good deal at one company, they can shop their business around, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. In San Francisco, I mean, a lot of drivers have the Lyft app open, the Uber app open, and they're sort of right. shopping around deciding
comparing
which to do.
Comparing prices. And the workers do that as well,
right.
where, you know, if the deal I'm getting from one company isn't acceptable, I can go to another company where I feel or my friends feel that the deal is better.
Right.
And that's probably a good argument for Uber, honestly. I mean, if a driver has Uber and Lyft open, then that's one of those tests that sort of signals that they're a true independent contractor because they do have the ability to work for Uber, to work for Lyft. They decide to go to Postmates. So there is a little bit of entrepreneurialism going on as a driver. The question is, how much freedom do they really, you know, have to choose?
Here's a listener email. Recently, SherpaShare surveyed over 200 on-demand workers, the majority from Uber and Lyft, about 86%, and nearly two-thirds of them considered themselves independent contractors, most of them citing reasons like the freedom and the flexibility. Mm-hmm. The pro-employee camp pointed out that the don't have control over their earnings due to the blind dispatch and rating threats. I'm not quite clear what that means. But there is this question of, like, whether you can choose your hours.
Yeah.
And if you can choose your level of engagement, that does seem to argue for independent contracting.
So I found this in my research also. So my taxi worker research that I did prior to the invention of Uber, I found that taxi workers often thought that they were independent contractors or even wanted to be independent contractors because they thought that that was the only way that they could have flexibility and choice. And it is why people have long gone into the taxi industry, right? It's why immigrant workers go into the taxi industry because they have transnational lives and they want to be able to go back and live in India for 6 months and come back and live here for 6 months. And that is the advantage of this type of work for sure. It's not clear to me, again, under the law, however, that type of flexibility is limited to being an independent contractor. So we're thinking about this in terms of what is our kind of colloquial understanding of an independent businessman versus what are the legal understanding of what is an employee. And you know, that's the reality. You can have that flexibility. I mean, what the commissioner found in the Berwick case is that, yes, they have this flexibility, but the Uber driver's work is integral to Uber's business model, and therefore that Uber driver is an employee of Uber.
We're talking about Uber and the 1099 economy as opposed to the W-2 economy. We'd love to hear from you, especially if you've driven for Uber or Lyft or the like, or really any software platform operator matching labor to demand. Call us at 866-733-6786, email us at forum@kqed.org, or head to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your questions there. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro. This hour, we're talking about Uber and the sharing economy, and we're asking for your comments and questions. Call us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Head to Facebook. Head to Twitter. We're watching on all platforms. And with that, we're going to go to our first call, Trevor in San Francisco.
Yeah, hi. I've actually been driving for Uber for roughly about 20 months now, and I'm somebody who I actually did come into this. I had other opportunities, and I did go to UC Berkeley. Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
This looked like a legitimate business opportunity. That's how Uber was actually marketing it. They were trying to get in people with grand claims that you can make this much. So I actually did buy a car to try to be what they call a partner to, you know, that can hire other people. I actually did spend thousands of my own money to try to get permits to go to the airport because up until recently it had been illegal. I was actually cited but not fined at SFO because it was illegal for Uber if you don't have the proper TCP or airport permits. And they just kept lowering the wages more and more and more. In the beginning of 2014, it went from an $8 minimum to a $5 minimum that they called a promotion. But you know, once the genie gets out of the bottle, it's never going to be back in. And then they've kept nickel and diming it more and more and more. Then they charge a dollar rider fee that they're actually not charging to the passenger. They're charging to the actual driver.
And so what are you feeling now? Do you want to continue with this or switch to a competitor?
I wanted to stick with Uber. It was something that I was really, really excited about. And now it's something that I've been trying to get out of doing for months. And it's something, you know, I took on all this extra overhead. It's kind of being trapped.
You're feeling trapped. Well, you know, I guess the question is, and it kind of goes along with an email that a listener has written in, speaking about Barbara Ann Berwick, the woman who sued Uber over back wages. This person knew what she got into when she started with Uber. She needs to take responsibility for her choices. What do you say, Trevor, to people who say, you know, that's unfortunate, but you made a bet and it didn't pan out?
And I guess there could be something to that, but it comes to trusting. You know, you actually try to trust somebody. And every time I've made a decision to try to invest in this company, I've made a really good decision. I've really thought it out. And then weeks later, the earth shifts under me. And there's just no stability to this. They want to retain people. I've lived here over 10 years. I can get in what they would say in about a 20-minute ride. I could probably get you there in about 10 because I know all the shortcuts. By just chewing up and spitting out people, you're actually getting rid of the people who were taking this seriously, who know the city, who actually take some pride in it, who take care of themselves and their car and their passengers and safety, and you're just going to the next cheapest option. I mean, I've taken Ubers even coming out of the airport, and there's drivers that already have their navigation system going. They're bringing in new people who are less trained and didn't know the area less well.
So it sounds like what you're describing is a kind of race to the bottom.
I would say that is exactly what I'm saying.
And if I could speak
and
to
there
that.
Are, I know there are a lot of people reading the blog. There are a lot of others like myself that got into doing this early and just feel like they've been really taken advantage of and really, you know.
Yeah, that's
the longer want to do.
Vina Dubal.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak to that. That's exactly what I found in my research when I started talking to Uber and Lyft drivers. When this started in 2012, there was a lot of excitement about the promise of the micro entrepreneur. You could build a brand, you could build a clientele, you could hustle, use your managerial skills to hire other people. You could be a small business owner. And there were people that were really excited about that, and that's when people started to leave the taxi industry. But because there is no regulation over the number of Ubers on the street, it quickly becomes a very simple math equation where you can't make a living. And on top of the fact that there's no regulation over the number of drivers there are on the street like there is in the taxi industry, you have exactly what Trevor is talking about. Uber sets the prices, and they are quickly shifting the ground under the feet of the drivers and the workers and the consumers, I should say.
Well, let me challenge
in a way
you
that makes it
Could
difficult.
You say that if Uber is shaving a penny here and a dollar there, that the market is going to self-correct at some point. Other drivers listening to Trevor here on the air will go, oh, okay, I've got the word, don't go work for Uber. And so in a way, Uber will write its own ticket south if it keeps cutting drivers
and
short.
I mean, Uber and Lyft both understand that, you know, if they have more drivers available, they'll have more consumers. I mean, it's one of those networks where you need both sides, right? So they're always trying to do everything they can to get as many drivers as possible. But Uber's also in the situation where they have literally billions of dollars that they've raised to sort of run experiments, right? And so drivers are getting caught in the middle of that, where Uber's saying, well, maybe we should discount and see how many riders we can get, and then maybe we'll pull back that discount, and all of a sudden, you know, the wages are going down, right? So it's just a very hard time for drivers, partially because there's so much turbulence in terms of Uber's business model as it's growing and figuring everything out.
And in some ways, this can all be distilled down to this. I mean, the question is about the role of government, right? That's really what this is about. The role of government and intervening in the economy. And do we believe that the free hand of the market is going to fix everything? Or is that going to take too long? And do we have to intervene? What we've seen in the taxi industry, what my research has shown over the course of the last 100 years of the chauffeur service, is that, in fact, there needs to be intervention to make sure that consumers are safe. You know, we're not we're not today. We're not talking about the insurance issues or the fact that this little girl was killed by a driver, an Uber driver, in January, I think, of 2013, that Uber didn't want to claim any responsibility for that. But there are reasons that we have had these regulations in the chauffeur industry for a long time. This isn't, you know, it's not just protectionism.
Well, along those lines, I hear you, Russ. Hold on just one second. Mike writes on Facebook, I thought taxi drivers were also technically independent contractors. It seems like all those issues apply to them as well. It wasn't necessarily all wine and roses during the days
Absolutely.
Of the taxis.
I mean, the Uber and Lyft and Sidecar are really just kind of an extension of what the taxi companies have been doing for a long time. The distinction is really just that Uber is not regulated in the same way, right? So in San Francisco, you have a finite number of cars, I think something around 1,800 medallions. There are no limits over how many Ubers are on the road. The
board there are 22,000 now, I think, is what Uber said last
That's
in San Francisco.
A lot of cars. Yeah. Russ Roberts, I know you wanted to jump in there.
Yeah. First, you know, response to the caller who was jerked around by Uber. The point of this isn't to defend Uber or glorify Uber or to suggest that they're a good-hearted company. They're trying to make money, like all companies. And like all drivers, we're all trying, and all employees, and all, whether we're independent or not, we're all trying to do the best we can for ourselves. If Uber does a lousy job and jerks people around, they're going to make it harder for people to be interested in driving for them. That's the fundamental question. And unfortunately, the regulation that Veena is championing is not solely there for the protection of the customer or for safety. Tragically, taxi drivers have had accidents, too. That's not the relevant issue here. The relevant issue is it good for folks? And regulation, we're talking about a major politically connected industry that in my area, I live outside Washington, D.C., suburban Maryland, major donations from the taxi cab monopoly are made to the county council to keep their wages, their profits high. Competition
is Uber is doing the same thing.
Oh,
they're
sure
hiring government regulators out from their jobs to serve as lobbyists, et cetera, et cetera.
They have to be because they are at risk of being totally shut down by a bunch of cronies who are the taxi cab companies. The taxi cab companies are a special interest. They have a monopoly. It's true, as Veena points out, you can't add to the number of cars on the road. There's a limit to the number of medallions. That means that on a rainy night in San Francisco or New York or Washington, D.C., without Uber, you're in trouble. You will not get a ride. With Uber and Lyft, you have an option now of getting a ride. You may have to pay a premium. It's your choice. You're free to use it or not use it. And the idea that we somehow have to stifle or quell that because people are going to make mistakes or because Uber might not treat its employees the way you think they should, it strikes me as really just is hubris.
Well,
I don't understand why it is necessary for the government to decide whether I can get in a car with a stranger or not. That's a remarkable thing. I get in the car with a stranger because Uber has created a confidence through its rating system, and it works remarkably well. Not perfectly. Nothing does. That's a good thing. And what the regulations we're talking about are fundamentally designed to end that good thing. Now, so if you
Right. Russ, let's get a few listener callers in there, too. Andrea in San Francisco raises an interesting issue. I've been an independent contractor for over 12 years and love the freedom and flexibility. However, I work in an industry where I can choose to be an employee or independent. I worry about the industries that are removing that choice and forcing people who want to be employees to unwillingly become contractors. I wonder, Eric Newcomer, whether we're not kind of conflating our concerns about the larger economy and industries where there isn't the kind of choice, an independent contractor really is a bald-faced lie, with what's happening with Uber and Lyft and some of these smaller sharing economy companies.
Yeah, I mean, the sharing economy largely is built on the independent contractor. There are counterexamples. Like I talked to Tree Tran at Muntree, which is actually has some of the same investors as Uber, and he's hired all his workers and his employees partially because he's sort of done the legal tests himself and thinks, well, I sort of have to do this. And he says openly, you know, if it was clearer that I could hire them as independent contractors, I'd think about it because I'd definitely save money. He thinks he'd save 30 to 40%. But there are also advantages for his business. You know, he, you know, when you have employees, you can tell them, you know, how to behave, how to dress. Like, those are the things you can tell employees to do.
If you need them to show up on Monday morning at 6,
exactly,
then they will.
Or for him, you know, it's a dinner time business mostly, so 5 to 9. And then, you know, he says, you know, those employees are the face of his business. So when they show up at your door with your meal, it's important to him to have some level of control that those are, like, well-trained people that will sort of build the Munchery brand. And so there are advantages in the sharing economy to having employees, and I think some startups are thinking about it.
And I think those things matter to workers too. I mean, the taxi workers that I talked to in my research don't want to have to wear uniforms, and that came up over and over and over again. If we become employees, does that mean that I have to wear a suit and a tie?
You give up a lot of freedoms.
So, yeah. And yeah, again, this is all about in some ways, this is about the amorphousness and capaciousness of the law. It's not clear that you would have to do those things or that they would make you do those things. It's possible. It's not clear. But those things matter a lot to a lot of people.
Because they affect people's lives. Alex in Oakland, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, hi. I just want to say I don't have any big words here, but I can tell you that we are experiencing Uber corporate now in our family because my husband is a driver, a town car driver. He's worked very hard. He's a professional. And I can tell you that Uber is disguising itself, is putting a lot of dreams out there, and is getting rich off of the working class, the working poor. We're a paycheck-to-paycheck family. My husband works so hard and struggles, and we're still just paycheck-to-paycheck. And I heard that professor, sounds like he works for Uber to me, but he said something about an interesting life. There's nothing interesting about working your butt off, not getting tips, and trying to make a living. There's no interesting life in that. It's an overcrowded city. It's competitive. And basically what Uber is doing is stripping what's left of the working class, the working slave, whatever you want to say, our rights away. They're not independent contractors. They're slaves. They're the ones who are telling the workers how much money they're going to make. If you're an independent contractor, you tell the employer how much you're going to make.
Well, Alex, let me challenge you there because, I mean, some people are looking to these companies to make a living, to pay the rent with what they're doing. Other people are just looking for it to make a little extra money. And in a sense, perhaps that creates an unlevel playing field on the employee side or the contractor side.
You know, to be honest with you, I live here in Oakland, and you can't afford rent if you're an Uber driver in San Francisco. A lot of these people are commuting.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, I haven't had my coffee yet. From Oakland to San Francisco, a lot of people, the working class has been pushed out because of the Uber corporate and the other techs coming into San Francisco and basically creating making the workforce move out. And you can't afford rent. That's why they're jumping from company to company, not because they have power of their own employment, but because they're desperate and they have to. And you heard the man before who was working for Uber, they're constantly choking down the amount of money they're paying their employees. I'm sorry, independent contractors.
That's okay. Alex, I do want to get some other comments and callers in, but thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Okay.
All right. One listener writes, Uber is a market maker. It provides a platform for demand to find supply and provides a market signal price for transactions. Our technology enables a new structure for economic transactions. We should be looking for new ways to educate and give labor a voice rather than forcing new business models into old regulation designed for old business models. Another listener writes, if you tried to get a taxi in San Francisco before Uber, you'll know why they came into being. Huge void to fill. If it was so great to drive taxis in SF, why weren't there any? We turn now to Waleed in San Francisco.
Hello.
Hi. So you're an Uber driver?
I am an Uber driver, and I'm currently driving right now. And I've been with Uber for 4 years, since they started, pretty much. And I've been through all these ups and downs. And I just want to answer that gentleman who says that, you know, if you don't like it, don't work for it. That is not an answer for an issue like this.
Why not, Wally? Why not just go work for a different company?
Well, you can't ask someone for a brand new car, make deals with all these car dealers to give you a car, a brand new car, and you don't even have a good credit, so you can work for them, and then you sign up that you're going to make this such amount of money, and the bank, they approve you for that loan, and then you go out there, and you end up paying 25% of the fare, which mostly $5 and $6 fares. You end up paying 25% and a dollar on top of that to Uber. So I'll just do the math, and if it's most of the fares are $5 and $6, you're going to end up making $3 out of that or $4.
It just doesn't add up. Wally,
yes. I just want to let everybody know that Uber drivers, when they tell the customers that they're happy, they are not. They're just afraid of Uber. They're afraid of Uber retaliation. I've been through this in perhaps I'd love for you guys,
to address that. Waleed, thank you for sharing our story. I want to bring in Russ Roberts since people keep mentioning him. Russ, I mean, we've heard from a couple of people now who say that they've basically invested in Uber, buying a car, leasing a car, made a bet, and maybe it worked for the first couple of years, but as working conditions and rules have changed, it's not working for them now. Doesn't that seem to call for some form of regulation, maybe not requiring Uber and Lyft and others to function like a taxi company, but some form of regulation to protect people from getting locked in that way?
Well, buying a car is a very it's a big capital cost. It's a big decision, and it's obviously tragic if you can resell it, of course, but you're going to lose some money on that deal.
It's a depreciating asset.
Absolutely. It's also, we've actually heard from three people who've made an investment and are disappointed how things turned out. That includes the limo driver who's invested in being a good limo driver, and now there's more competition. His salary is going down. His opportunities to earn fares go down. This happens in a vibrant economy. Things change, and certain people benefit, and certain people get hurt. And that's a fact. It's true. And the question then is, what should we do about it? Should we cushion people from the blows of the dynamic economy, or should we make the economy less dynamic? And I tend to fall on the latter side. I think it'd be better to educate people about what the risks are. Probably should hear from a few other Uber drivers than the two who've called in, may not be representative. But I think the question is, in general, is it going to make the world a better place to make Uber more restricted by regulation? And the answer to that is going to depend on what the regulations are. So I want to come back to what I said almost an hour ago, which is that if we make Uber treat its drivers better, there is going to be a challenge that means that there are going to be less Uber drivers. More want to do it, but fewer will be able to do it because their prices, I think, will have to be higher.
So there are economic trade-offs no matter what restrictions you impose on the market.
There's no free lunch. So I just, what I would encourage everybody to think about is when we impose a regulation, sometimes it's a good idea, but it's never free. Some are not good ideas because the costs are so high, and often those costs fall on the people we're trying to help. Again, I think it would be key to talk to some more Uber drivers.
Well, along that lines, we do have a happy driver lined up.
If you're one of them, that would be awesome.
Well,
here
we go, Russ. Here's Noah in Berkeley. Hi, Noah.
Hi. Thanks for hearing me. I called a bunch of times because I am passionate about this issue, and I am a happy driver. I've only been driving less than 4 months for Uber and Lyft, and I'm an underdog, and I always want to fight for the underdog. I understand everyone wants to fight for the underdog, for the unhappy drivers, and when I have a slow day, I'm unhappy also. But let me be clear, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me. I mean, and I have a college degree, but I'm not a corporate type of person.
Noah, are you looking to this work to pay the rent or just to add on to the bank account a little bit?
No, well, I'm paying the rent on this right now, and I definitely don't want to be a chauffeur for the rest of my life. But on good days, my best day has been $485. You know, I've made $2,000 a week. Many weeks. I have to work a lot for that, but I'm really grateful for the opportunity to be able to have that much work. I can work anytime I want to, 24 hours a day.
Where do you drive?
Noah,
where do you drive? Do you drive in San Francisco or Berkeley?
I drive in San Francisco. Yeah, it's not as much work in the East Bay, in my experience. So I go to San Francisco. And that's the thing. It's like, so I have other opportunities to do other jobs, but like I don't want a government-regulated job. When I heard about this becoming like an employee type of job, it just sounds like bad news. It's like there's a lot of restrictions. It's like, what does the government do? The minimum wage is very low. Uber drivers make about, $25 to $30 an hour. And so maybe I'm smart or I'm fortunate that my used car was only $6,000. And it's a Toyota. It's a small Toyota. So it makes sense.
So you made a more clever financial bet by not getting into an expensive car.
Right. So if I had a German car or a European car, yeah, I probably would be less happy. I would make less money, be able to keep less of it. But I spend about $20 a day on gas and can make, on average, it's like $25 to $30. I have to work smart. I have to be in the right places at the right times. I'm really happy. Like, I definitely don't feel secure. Like, this is a lifelong career for me. So those people.
But then you're not looking for a security. You're looking for something temporary. Noah, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us.
Thanks.
One listener emails, why is there no mention of the Flywheel app? For those of you who haven't used it, it allows you to catch a traditional cab and pay for it with your smartphone. Eric Newcomer, this seems to point to the fact that this new transition to using technology has forced the traditional industry, in this case, to up its game and to deliver, in a sense, a better service to customers.
Certainly, certainly. I mean, yeah, you see a lot of old school companies, trying to find ways online. I mean, Flywheel is a great app. I think I used it for a while. It seems like a little bit more expensive than Uber and Lyft right now, based on my sort of anecdotal observations, but works very well and you can summon a taxi cab very easily. So definitely the taxi cab industry is trying to stay relevant. It's hard for them, to function, I think, on an app with the same regulations they do in the taxi cab industry, limited medallions against, a fleet of cars that can grow sort of as much as demand requires.
But what Flywheel is centralized dispatch. And this is a different show, but I think that part of the problem with taxi service in San Francisco was not just the limited number of medallions, but also the fact that that there was no centralized dispatch, which is something that workers' rights folks in the taxi industry have been pushing for a long time to improve service. And that's what Uber is, centralized dispatch with a lot of cars.
It does sound like we're talking about possibly a regulatory overhaul of the taxi cab industry in some ways so that it can better compete with new competitors, but also to address some of the longstanding issues that were just kind of lying unaddressed for so many years.
I mean, this is happening in every state and city around the country right now.
In the world.
I mean, it's because Uber and Lyft are, literally going to cities like Houston and talking with city council members and saying, the regulation should look like this. The taxi industry is coming to them and saying it should look like this. So, there's a patchwork of laws and regulations. Every city is different. I mean, Washington, D.C. is known to have super friendly ride-sharing regulations. Houston's been pretty hostile. I think Kansas City, Lyft left because it was so hard on ride-sharing. So right now we're having this discussion everywhere. Like, are Uber and Lyft basically taxi companies or not? Different cities are saying different things. And I don't think there's going to be a universal answer. Maybe Congress.
So you don't think the ruling this week from the California Labor Commission is going to have that big an impact?
Well, it's one facet of their business. I think the question of whether Uber and Lyft drivers are independent contractors in every state is going to matter a ton for those businesses. I just think that there are a lot of questions about whether Uber and Lyft should fit into the existing regulatory regime in terms of taxi cabs, whether that regime was too strict in the first place, and those questions are being sorted out across the country and internationally right now.
And as it seems to be happening on a local level.
Yeah. It's the power of city government. I mean, these cities have set up rules around their taxi cab industries. So Uber and Lyft have literally had to send people to each of these cities to talk with city council members. I mean, it's amazing to see the political process at work.
Carly in Oakland has a question for Vina Dubal. What do you want to have happen with Uber?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, my role as a law professor is to ask lots of questions. And that's kind of what I've done at this point. I think that, you know, from just a personal standpoint, I would like to see Uber regulated much more robustly and to have workers protected. I think that Russ is right, that this is, you know, that the taxi industry is not kind of an angel in this context. Taxi companies have been pushing back against progress for a really long time, both for workers and for consumers. But the kind of crux of the question for me that Uber raises, that Lyft raises, that all of these kind of so-called sharing economy or sharing the scraps economy, as workers like to call it, all these companies raise is that with the growth of this freelance economy, you know, by 2020, we have 50% of the U.S. workforce projected to be independent contractors. We have the decline of the welfare state. All of our energy is put onto employment regulation to help workers. What are we going to do about this? How are we going to make sure there's a safety net?
Well, with that open question, we're going to have to bring it to a close. Thank you so much, Vina Dubal, Associate Professor at UC Hastings College of the Law, Russ Roberts, Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and Eric Newcomer, Reporter for Bloomberg Business. A pleasure talking with you all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro. Stay with us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.